Thursday, July 1st, a most memorable day. I got up in time to have one more lovely walk through Mary's garden and down past the swimming pool, surrounded by chaise lounges and comfortable chairs, with a broad swath of green bordered with pink and red geraniums, and behind them rhododendron are large blooming shrubs, now green, of course, and then the great elms. And then she talked about her plans. Mary always has plans for the continuation of the beautification program. She asked me if we had someone from federal housing on our committee. Perhaps we should work toward getting 1% from federal housing's budget set aside for use in planting. Second, we just must work on the education angle, listing the interests of teachers, 4-H clubs, home economists, garden clubs, girl and boy scouts. The whole attitude of the next generation must be changed if this country is to be preserved and made more beautiful. Third, how about involving labor unions? Maybe we ought to see Walter Reuther. He's a man with ideas. Maybe he would make speeches to his innumerable members. And then, there ought to be some sort of message from me, thought Mary. The time to reach the September editions of the women's magazines, urging a fall planting. In everybody's yard, one climbing rose, one flowering crabapple or dogwood, or whatever is most indigenous to the land you live in. A little after 11, Mary and I left for the FDR Library. There we were met by Dr. Elizabeth Drury, the head of the library, who had been my guest at one of the women doers' luncheon. Juanita and Dorothy had already preceded us. Having them there was Lyndon's wonderful idea. What they would absorb would mean something to the future of our library, if ever, and it would certainly mean something, I believe, to their pleasure and to mine for being with them. I doubt if I shall ever really like another one of the presidential libraries as well as this. It is so intimate to the man, to President Roosevelt. His home is there, the Rose Garden, the lovely view of the Hudson River. It is so much a part of his life. The library itself accords well with the landscape and with the Hyde Park House. I dare say, in modern standards, it might be considered old-fashioned already, in that there are so many exhibits, so many things. A sort of mixed-up fashion. So was his desk, always. So was their house. I found the whole thing wonderful. I especially loved seeing his beautiful christening robe, the little wicker bassinet, the dainty white canopy, the letter he wrote the man inquiring if his ancestry was Jewish, which he said he had neither the inclination nor the time to look it up. He referred to his earliest ancestor in this country 6 or 7 generations back, said that he only hoped they were good citizens who contributed to their country, whether they were Jewish, Catholic, or Protestant. Cold, cutting, great letter. What delightful family pictures. How much prettier Mrs. Roosevelt was as a young girl than what one hears would have you believe. It was a little tartan, some Scottish clan that had been given to FDR when he was about 4 years old. Delightful. He is said to have hated to have to put it on. I like seeing the car that he drove, with their special equipment so that he never had to use his feet, and the sleigh in which the family went riding on snowy winter days. It had belonged to one of the czars of Russia and had been purchased for $24 by one of FDR's ancestors. There were some letters to Lyndon, and from Lyndon to President Roosevelt, and some from Mrs. Roosevelt. One of the most impressive things of all was a silver bowl which had belonged in the Roosevelt family for the Revolutionary War. It had been made by the silversmith who taught Paul Revere his trade as silversmith. There was one room called, tactfully, the Chamber of Oddities. It housed all those peculiar things one gets, including a large stone sphinx bearing the face of FDR, made at the time when no one knew whether he was going to run for a third term. Dr. Drury introduced us to all the staff. We went into the stacks. More and more it was emphasized to me that really it is the endless lines of American families who come from all over the country to see these remembrances of a presidency and of a day in our history. But yet, in the research room, there were several students. There was a display of some 8 or 10 volumes that were on the market about the life of Roosevelt by historians who had done their work here in this library. Not all historians. One of them was Helen Gehagen Douglas, written about Mrs. FDR. There are many lacks. For instance, there's no auditorium. There will be one when the money is raised to build the wing to house Mrs. Roosevelt's papers. My trip made me glad of everything we had saved, glad we'd had an early beginning, sorry about all the wonderful things I had lost or thrown away along the way. About halfway through the day, I began to have the most awful stomach ache, a familiar one. I've had it before, but I was too interested to stop. There were many tourists, but only one newspaper man. He chose a couple of interesting spots, at President Roosevelt's own desk in his office, in front of a display of family photographs where he took pictures, and I was happy to have the tourists take them everywhere. Most of all, I think, I loved going through the house. An early family portrait, done by Stuart, no less. How much that says of the family. And then there was a pretty gay chintz, what was called the Dresden Room, which was put on, they told me, to get ready for the visit of the King and Queen of England, time they served them the famous hot dogs. The whole day was a delight. Stopped long enough to go to a Howard Johnson's for lunch and took Dr. Drury with us. Practically every youngster in the whole place, and there must have been 50, came over to ask me for an autograph. Fortunately, I had a purse full of the little cards I signed, our best signs for me in the White House, and gave them out gladly to them. One lady sitting behind me leaned over and said, "Mr. Johnson, we have just returned from Europe, and we feel a little guilty because we traveled so far and saw so many trashy things. Now I want to see our own beautiful country." Truly, the Valley of the Hudson is hard to beat. We had a plane to catch in New York, so we took just a few brief minutes to drive back past the vast, magnificent Vanderbilt home, given by some member of the family, none of us knew whom, to the National Park Service. Palace with towering Corinthian columns overlooking the Hudson. Then we said goodbye to Mary, drove back over the Taconic Parkway to a plane, Anita and I. Dorothy had continued on her vacation in the Catskills with her husband, brought the plane and reached the White House around 8 o'clock. And there, oh, delight of my life, was Linda Bird, home for Lucy's baptism tomorrow and for her birthday party. Beth was there, and Warren Lynn, and Lucy, of course. But Linda and I settled down on my bed, talked and talked and talked. It's the real essence of life, to talk quietly with one of your children. Summer has certainly not been utter joy for Linda, but it has been full of humor, learning, seeing America, using an awful lot of muscles, and I think she's grown by it. I'm delighted she's doing it. If she writes a good article, it will mean something to her self-esteem, and it will add to her maturity. I thought about tomorrow, and I face it as a sort of goodbye, a change, but the change is really already made. There was a sneering, sarcastic article by Douglas Kiker in the Herald Tribune called "The President's Image Analysis, Discussion of Jack Valenti's Speech About Lyndon in Boston." Act number 2, following the Herblock cartoon, in which Lyndon was the plantation owner with a bullwhip and his office staffs were cowering Uncle Toms. I suppose we shall see in the next few weeks who all are members of this cabal.